Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Today's guest is Dr. Joseph O. Baker, an assistant professor of sociology and anthropology at Eastern Tennessee State University and a senior research associate at the American Religious Data Archives. He was brought to my attention by Chris Bader, a previous guest on our program and one of Professor Baker's mentors and co-authors when Chris and Joseph were both at Baylor University. Joseph has written broadly on the topic of religion in American life with academic articles covering such areas as angelic representations in folk religion, the link between religion and paranormal beliefs, problem drinking in teenagers, gender differences in secular beliefs, the teachings of creationism in public schools, and belief in hell and other punitive theologies. He is the author of two books, Paranormal America, Ghost Encounters, UFO Sightings, Bigfoot Hunts, and Other Curiosities in Religion and Culture, co-authored with Chris Bader and Carson Mencken, and most recently, American Secularism, Cultural Contours of Non-Religious Belief Systems, written with Buster G. Smith. I should note that the book on paranormal activity will be coming out in a new edition early this coming year, actually early in the fall, I think, or maybe in 2017, and we're planning to have Chris Bader back on in late October to talk about that spooky book, so stay tuned for our annual Halloween episode with Chris Bader. We will also link to Professor Baker's biography, his books, and lots of other fun, informative things over at our website, so please check it out. Joseph, welcome to Research on Religion.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I think it would be fair to call you a sociologist of religion, which is a subcategory of sociology that really hasn't been that popular recently, as especially compared to the past. Further, you tend to write about things that tend to be on the fringes of religiosity, including the paranormal. We just mentioned that book on Bigfoot and UFO sightings, as well as stuff like the belief in Satan, which you've done some papers on. So, you know, wow. How did you intellectually get to this place where you are now?
Well, it's true that the sociology of religion is probably not the most popular field. I got interested in it. I was raised in southern Appalachia, and that's a region where I work now as well. And so a very religious area, lots of different types of interesting religion around. And so I was very interested in religion and its different forms and how religion linked to different parts of society. And as a sociology major and undergraduate work, there was no class in religion, which I found really fascinating and quite lacking, given that so many people are religious for so many different reasons and in different ways. So, being a bit of a contrarian, I guess, I decided to take that up as a challenge to try to study religion from a sociological perspective. And so that's kind of how I got interested in the general study of it. And then for the different topics, I'm always, my curiosity is piqued by things we haven't quite studied really thoroughly yet. And so I was drawn to areas like belief in Satan and hell and demons and the study of the paranormal, which I kind of got into through knowing Chris. And so I was interested in things like that because if you look at those, they're not marginal in the statistical sense. A majority of Americans believe in hell or Satan, or a majority of Americans hold some type of paranormal belief. So I decided to kind of look at those things, some of those corners we hadn't quite peeked in yet.
Yeah. So a majority of Americans believe in some kind of paranormal stuff, be it UFOs to ghosts to Bigfoot.
That's right. If you just said, do they believe in at least one thing, and we took a list of things, say UFOs, Bigfoot, ghosts, astrology, ancient civilizations like Atlantis or something like that, and we said how many Americans believe in at least one, it's over 60%.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Like I said, again, we'll have Chris Bader on our show later in October to be talking about that book that you co-authored with him, which is kind of neat. Do you get people raising their eyebrows at you when you talk about this stuff, saying, you tell them, I'm a sociologist. Say, oh, what do you study? Well, Bigfoot and hell. And they're like,
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And all of my friends and family now know me sort of as like the Bigfoot guy, so I get lots of gifts with Bigfoot themes. And, of course, I love it. You know, I think the stuff is really interesting. And so usually people maybe look askance, but then once you start to engage and tell some stories and explain what's going on, I tend to find that people, although they may kind of look at it strangely at first, tend to have some interest in it on their own, whether they believe in it or not. They're still interested in why, if they don't believe, other people believe, or if they believe, they're interested in why other people do. And so there's some skepticism, but usually that gives way to interest at some point.
Yeah, with over 60% believing in at least one of these things, there's going to be some interest out there, and it's a great conversation starter. Let's talk about your new book, though, and that was out last year with NYU Press. We'll link to it on our website. This book takes on the hot topic of growing American secularism, and there's been quite a few books and articles with respect to the rise of religious nuns out there in recent years. First of all, why has this topic become so hot, and how did you get into the study?
Well, there's two parts to that. The reason it has become such a hot topic is because of the rapid increase in Americans who say they have no religion. And that's part of why I got into it to begin with as well. If you look at for the general social survey, which we use a lot for the book, in 1990, about 8% of Americans would have said they had no religion when asked, what's your religious preference? 8% would have said none or no religion. But by the 2000s, and especially by about 2010 or so, we were up over 20% of respondents saying that they had no religion. And so that's a pretty rapid transformation as far as religious markets go. And so I thought that in and of itself sort of was interesting, and I wanted to know what was going on with that. So we started doing this in about 2006, and I was a graduate student at the time. And so we'd seen this number sort of ticking upward in the no religion category. And Buster Smith was also in graduate school with me at the same time. And so we had a shared interest in this question of who are religious nuns and why does there seem to be this increase going on? And the more we looked at it, the more interested we got, because the two kind of dominant paradigms that have been used to explain religious affiliation in the United States would be, say, like secularization versus sort of the rational choice or religious economy's perspective. But neither of those seem particularly suited to answer this question, so it didn't seem like if we take sort of classical secularization theories, it's not as if the United States suddenly became more quote-unquote modern in the 20 years between 1990 and 2010, or if we took sort of the religious economy's perspective, it's not as if religious supply had shifted drastically in that amount of time. So both of the big kind of idea, sort of paradigms that would be used normally to explain this seemed like they didn't have an easy answer, and so that kind of piqued our interest in it. So we decided to pursue it and try to see what we could find out.
Now, you said we, the person that you're co-authoring this with is Buster Smith. And how did you meet him, and what was his role in this book?
So Buster was a year ahead of me in graduate school. So we basically shared an office together. And for all intents and purposes, basically shared all of our research ideas and drafts of papers and all those sorts of things with each other. For the entire time we were in school. And we shared this interest in this question of religious nuns or secularity and especially the American case and what was going on with it. So we decided to work together on these different papers. It started as writing journal articles and kind of grew from there. We started with a really basic question of who says they have no religion? And the more we sort of pried into that question, the more complicated things got, and so every time we seemed to answer something, we raised four or five new questions, and so we just kind of kept going down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. You're sharing office with him when you're able to come up with these ideas so other graduate students take note. A co-author might just be sitting right next to you. This wasn't something that you snuck in like at midnight and you looked at all Buster's notes and say, hey, he's got a good dissertation topic. I'm going to take it. He did the same thing, and then you've discovered that you might as well write it together.
Yeah, well, this is something where we were always talking about anything we were working on.
Okay.
And he, I should say, too, he's also, I do quite a bit of statistics, but he is a very math-oriented thinker. And so, and I tend to be a little more on the theoretical side, and so we kind of complemented each other. And we kind of started at the beginning. We started fresh, both of us at the same time working on this. So we kind of began working on it from the get-go. So we didn't really come to it with a lot of preconceived ideas on either one of our parts. We kind of discovered things as we went along.
Okay, so nothing nefarious. You weren't stealing each other's ideas late at night and in the office, were you?
No. Okay. In fact, our dissertations are quite different. You know, his main area was American Buddhism. And I did stuff on science and religion and whether or not that people are into creationism or accept evolution or these sorts of things. Yeah. So our main topics were actually different. We just shared. We had this overlap in this area, and so. We didn't use this stuff for thesis or dissertation or anything. We were just doing research on it together.
Okay. So I want to back up and talk about the title of your book a minute. It says American Secularism, Cultural Contours of Non-Religious Belief Systems. And so when you pick that book off the shelves, you're probably going to go, oh, okay, this is going to be Christianity versus atheist in essence. But a term that you use quite a bit throughout the book is othered. And I want you to discuss what that means, because I think this book differentiates a lot of belief systems in the United States better than the old atheist or believer type of dichotomy.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the main things we were trying to dispel in many ways is this idea that it's atheist versus highly religious people, and that's the noteworthy distinction. And instead, what we were thinking of it as is sort of a large continuum that might run from, let's say, whatever you want to call it, like zealotry or something, where it's just like absolute commitment to, say, a religious belief system versus a strident form of atheism, where it's absolute the opposition to religion and complete lack of religion or spirituality. And instead, what we thought of it as is we want to kind of look at all these shades in between. Not that the ends of that continuum aren't important, they are. But when people see headlines, with this rise in people saying no religion, there's been a lot of headlines about America becoming more secular, and a lot of times people just assume that's atheist. But we actually find that the big increase in this is not really about atheists, it's about this middle category that we end up calling non-affiliated believers, who is people, when you ask what's their religion, they say none or no religion. And then if you ask a theism question later, they say they believe in God or some type of cosmic force, which is more of kind of like a deistic answer. And so it seemed, you know, once we started kind of digging into it, that it was more this these liminal in-between categories where all the kind of action was. Now, in terms of the idea of something being othered, that comes from the study of criminology and deviance. And what we mean by that is just constructing an identity against another identity, or sort of a constructed outgroup. And a lot of times, if you look at, say, the rhetoric of the religious right in the 1980s, there's a lot of talk about atheists and secular humanists and not that they're, you know, actually interviewing atheists or secular humanists to see who they are, but kind of constructing their belief system or their identity against this outgroup. And on the flip side, a lot of what is sometimes called new atheism, although it's not really that new, but a lot of that sort of constructs itself against this othered kind of boogeyman of organized religion, which is causing people to be ignorant and sort of impeding social progress and all these sorts of things. So when you look at this, a lot of times the discourse you hear back and forth will tend to come from somebody on one of those poles. So you have sort of the new atheist decrying and othering organized religion, or you might have somebody who's a representative of organized religion decrying atheism and lack of belief. And so those are important parts of understanding the cultural dynamics of secularism. But once you kind of pry into it, there's more interesting middle ground that a lot of times gets left out.
Yeah, you use that term secularism once again, and that's right there in the title, too. And titles mean a lot. That's, we look at titles and see it on the bookshelf, and it's our first impression of the book. And you give a much more nuanced picture of what secularism means. Actually, the first question I have is that the title of the book that you wanted, or was this suggested by the publisher?
A little of both. Okay. I actually wanted to call it American Secularisms with sort of like an S in parentheses, and I was told that's not good for searches on the internet and things like that, and that it needs to be something that people can stick to, because part of like the main argument we make in the book is that there's not a singular secularism. There are different varieties and flavors of secularisms, just like there are different varieties and flavors of religion. But in the end, I think the publisher was right that it needs to be sort of something that gets people's attention, and you don't want to throw too much nuance out there on the title. Now, I will say, a lot of people, I think, will object to the way we use secularism, because I'm sure, as you know, as a political scientist, a lot of times secularism is used to refer to specific types of government where there's not an official or established religion. And so we're using it in a much broader way than that. So there may be some confusion on that level. The problem was there wasn't another good singular term that captured what we wanted, and secularism seemed to work best. So we used it even though we knew there might be a little bit of misunderstanding there. And we tried to clarify, you know, the subtitle tries to clarify that, yeah, we're more interested in the ideology than sort of the governmental structure of it.
Yeah, so go ahead and clarify that for us, and this will help guide the rest of our discussion here. So when we do talk about secularism and another term you use, secularity, what are we talking about in terms of your research?
We use secularism in the sense of an ideology that is explicitly non-religious in orientation, and by that we mean it's explicitly saying that it is not privileging a religion, or in some cases that it is against a religion, although it doesn't have to be against. And of course, that could apply to a government which is trying to have, say, secular rule of law or something like that. So it can apply there, but the ism part of it we used as an ideology. So we think of it as a constellation of ideas that are created explicitly to be non-religious. With secularity, we had that more in mind as an identity. Think of it as sort of the flip side of religiosity. If religiosity is active participation in religion, then secularity would be something like an identity constructed out of a non-religious belief system. So we used secularism as ideology and secularity or secularity to mean identity. So somebody saying, for instance, I'm an agnostic or I'm an atheist, we would count that as a form of secularity. Or the popular one now, I'm spiritual but not religious. We'd call that a form of, well, it's debatable whether that's secularity or a form of privatized spirituality, but that's part of the point, I think.
Yeah. Another term that you use quite frequently throughout the book is cosmic belief system. How does that term relate to all of this?
So here's what we wanted to accomplish with that. You noted that I have done some studies of the paranormal. So I think that the paranormal and paranormal beliefs and paranormal experiences should be studied by fields that are engaged in the study, quote unquote, of religion. I also think the same thing that fields that are engaged in the study of religion, say the psychology of religion or the economics of religion, should study forms of secularism, so atheism, agnosticism, or whatever it may be. But some of this is precluded by tacking on the of religion into our titles. And so basically, the way a lot of theories are set up, in order for me to study, say, atheism, I would have to find a way to say, oh, well, it's really a form of religion by using like a functional definition of religion and saying people get ultimate meaning from their atheism, therefore I'm going to study it like I would religion. But that's kind of misleading to say that atheism is religion. So what we tried to do is come up with a broader umbrella term that underneath it we could have organized religion, we could have privatized versions of spirituality, we could have paranormalism of all its different varieties, of which there are many, and we could have secularisms, of which there are many, and say that we should essentially be engaged in studying all of these different things. And we're not trying to necessarily privilege one or the other, but we think they're all of interest to fields that are engaged in the study of religion. So it's a bit clunky, I guess, in the, you know, the cosmic modifier to it. But what we wanted to accomplish is the idea that there's an umbrella term under which we can make these different distinctions between organized religion or privatized spirituality or paranormalism or whatever. But to say that we should really be engaged in studying all of these things and not just limited to organized religion.
So one of the questions that comes up, and you mentioned this again, you say secularisms, right? And we touched upon this a little bit, but I want you to dive into that a little bit more, that there's more than just one secularism. So they must look somehow different, that you could line them up against the wall and say, okay, there's that type, there's this type, there's that type. And you combine this, too, with some demographic research and some research on individuals' beliefs. So explain what secularisms is and explain what that looks like today here in the United States.
Sure. Now, we end up outlining four very broad categories. And I think you could actually refine those if you had a much narrower scope. But what we ended up wanting to do was almost create something like, you know, in the study of religion, we have this thing. In the U.S., we use this scheme called religious tradition or RELTRAD to categorize, say, survey data. And we put people as conservative Protestants or mainline Protestants, Catholics, Jewish. And, we use these different categories. We almost wanted to create a version of that for secularism or secularisms. And so to do that, we said our four main categories would be atheist, that is someone who says there is no God, and then agnostic, someone who thinks that the question of God is kind of beyond humans' capabilities to answer, and they can't say for certain. And then we have the non-affiliated believer group I mentioned, which is somebody who says no religion, but then to a theism question says that they believe in God of some sort. And then we also use a fourth category we call cultural religion, which is people who affiliate and believe in God, but they don't practice. That is, they rarely, if ever, attend religious services, and they don't pray. So we kind of use a public form of practice and a private form of practice. And we call that cultural religion, meaning essentially that there's some signification there where, you know, it still means something. Someone might say, well, I'm Catholic. I don't practice, but I was raised that way. So that it still means something to them. But it's not the same as an engaged form of religiosity. So we use those four categories. But even within that, you could make, and qualitative studies do this, they make finer distinctions between them. So, for instance, with an agnostic, you could make even finer distinctions. Somebody could be sort of firmly agnostic. My favorite version of this is the bumper sticker that says, militant agnostic, I don't know, and you don't either. Or you could be kind of like the softer version of somebody who just says, I don't know, you know, I've thought about it and I really don't know, or I'm apathetic. So you could make even finer sort of distinctions within the categories we create, but we intended them to be useful for empirical researchers to kind of put them in action.
Okay. And in terms of these categories, what does America look like in terms of atheist, agnostic, the non-affiliated believers, and these cultural religion folks?
In terms of numbers, atheists are the smallest group. They're at around 3% of the American public that would say they're atheists. Now, interestingly, you get different levels, and we try to highlight this a little bit. You get different levels if you make people identify with the term atheist than you do if you just ask people, do you believe in God? and provide the option, I don't believe there's a God. More people say, I don't believe there's a God than identify with the label atheist. Hmm. Part of that is because of this sort of negative connotation that comes along with the term atheism. But anyway, you can assume atheists and people who don't believe in God are about 3% using the GSS, and that one uses belief rather than self-identification with the label. Agnostics are between 4 to 6%, and again, you could break that down into people who are more apathetic and people who are more sort of firm in their agnosticism, but about 4 to 6%, about 5% of the population is a good estimate for agnostics. The non-affiliated believer group is the one that, the main one that's been growing. And now we're up over, I believe we're close to about 15% on that. You could say they're this non-affiliated believer, spiritual but not religious, all these different sort of varieties within that. And the cultural religion group tends to be right around 10%. 10% of Americans identify and believe but don't practice. And so if you sum all those up, then you're getting close to 25 to 30% of the population. And so we're kind of trying to reclaim this fairly large swath of the population as being important for study.
Now, are there certain demographics that tend to fall into these categories more often than not? Say, for instance, non-affiliated believers. Is that a young person thing? Is it a male thing? Is it particular to a certain race or ethnicity?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where we kind of began looking into this. But our initial effort to look into this by what we did at first, something now we kind of retrospectively see as being a bit of a mistake, we just threw in all the people who said no religion. We counted atheists, agnostics, together with the non-affiliated believer group. And the reason that turns out to be an important thing that differentiates those groups is that non-theists, so that would be atheists or agnostics, tend to be of higher social class, especially with education, and have higher levels of education, whereas the non-affiliated believer group tends to be of lower social class, lower education, lower income. And so there's a difference there, and as we're kind of pursuing this out in the book and then future studies, there turns out to be a lot of differences across those groups. But that's one right away where there's a big difference. There's so the non-theists tend to be of higher social class, and the non-affiliated believer group tends to be of lower social class. Overall, all of these categories are more common among younger generations of Americans. Now, there are age effects to this, too, life course effects, such that people who are, say, in their 20s are more likely to claim one of these things than people who are in their 50s. So some people who are in their 25 say that they're an atheist may be religiously affiliated believers by the time they're 40. There's some cycling back in on that. But there are distinct generational effects you can see in trend data where younger generations are more likely to be all of these things, although especially that non-affiliated believer group concentrated among younger Americans. There are some really interesting distinctions by race, white Americans and Asian Americans are the most likely to be secular. And there's a really interesting pattern with Asian Americans, such that it's second generation immigrants who have the highest level of claiming no religion among Asian Americans. So first generation immigrants tend to claim religions of origin, so say Buddhism or Hinduism or something like that. Second generation, kind of caught between parents and American culture, has a really high rate of claiming no religion. And then once you get to third or later generations of Asian Americans, they basically look like white Americans. There's lower levels of non-religion and really high levels of Protestantism, in particular evangelical Protestantism. So that's an interesting one. Hispanic Americans, there's a fascinating dynamic we found with assimilation, such that the Hispanic Americans that were the most likely to be non-religious of some variety were the most assimilated in the sense of English dominant, high levels of social class, and then the group with the lowest level of secularity were the ones that were Spanish-speaking dominant, lower levels of socioeconomic status, so as assimilation increased, levels of secularity increased among Hispanic Americans. Among African Americans, there are very low levels of secularity of any type, which still speaks to the importance of the black church in organizing the African American community. And so there, you do see a lot of interesting dynamics here. And you again, with all these things, you could parse them further if we go dig into any of those categories, like Asian Americans, and start to sort of drill down into country of origin, whether you're looking at Japan or China. You find there are different dynamics in each of these. So in a lot of ways, we're kind of outlining a very broad look at this, hoping that other people will go in and pull some of these particulars out even further.
It's interesting you mentioned this pattern among Asians and then to a lesser extent among Latinos. The second generation tend to be much more secular, and then by the third generation they start looking more like white or Caucasian Americans. What do you think is going on there?
I mean, as best we can tell, it seems to be a process of assimilating to American culture. And again, you know, the second generation is kind of caught in between, you know, the culture of immigrant parents and an American culture where you're trying to figure out how to be sort of this liminal generation between where your parents came from a different country and assimilating to American culture. And as the generations go further, there's a fuller process of assimilation. And, you know, for better or worse, Christianity is still tied to American identity in a lot of ways, in rhetoric, in terms of like sort of political discourse. And so, or even if we just think about it in sense of community involvement, you know, using churches as a way to get involved in communities. And so I think there's a process of assimilation that accounts for a lot of that transition away from essentially Eastern religions to what are more quote unquote Western religions.
Mm-hmm. The other question I had too goes back to what you were talking about with respect to age categories. And you notice there's a generational effect. Now, I don't know how much panel data you're using, or you're just using the time series questionnaires from the General Social Survey. But is this a pattern where you see younger people, because they're in their 20s and they're not married and they're footloose and fancy free, they're not going to church. But, you know, when they settle down in their 30s and in the 40s, they got their kids and stuff, they start going back to church? Or is there something different about this younger generation? Or do we even know how to analyze that?
Both of those things are true. We're mainly using trend data, but there are panel studies that show, first of all, one of the main things panel studies show is that there's a lot of oscillation between these categories. There was this a panel study that was done over the course of a year that showed a lot of shifting in and out of this no religion category, even in the space of a year. So we talk about how these categories over time are quote-unquote fuzzy. But even though there are aging effects such that older Americans are more likely to be religious, there are distinctive generational effects such that younger generations are more likely to do, there's a few things. One of the most important is to drop out. We call this the apostasy rate. That is, if you're raised in a religion, and then as an adult you say, I have no religion. Now again, you may come back to that later, but we don't find that people coming back to that, there's a much more, a higher level of people dropping out, and there's not enough of a life force effect to account for all of that. So there's still a generational effect where younger people are more likely to drop out. So there's a much higher apostasy rate among younger generations of Americans than there were among earlier generations at the same age level.
That's really interesting. But this has not just been a generational thing, right? This goes back pretty deep in history. And how has American secularism developed over time? I mean, one of the things that you state in your book, you said, you asked the question, how did secularity become a socially viable religious preference? That wasn't always the case, but there's always been secularism floating around throughout American history. So tell us about this big history.
Sure. And in doing some of the historical work, in a lot of ways, we're confined to either organized versions of secularism or written forms of it. But, you know, there's no surveys then, so we can't really say the levels in the population. But nonetheless, the format of it and the way it's argued, in some ways there's a lot of consistency in the arguments you see from secularisms of different generations. And in some ways, there's a change in the style or content of it. So we kind of start this with Thomas Paine and looking at, and Paine's important because he is influential for trying to spread deism. And for a long time, rationalist or secular ideas were primarily spread with the idea of deism. So in some sense, and Paine even begins the Age of Reason by saying, I believe in one God. And so in some sense, secular ideas were sort of spread in the garb of God talk. And so that in itself is very interesting. Paine was important because, not because of what he said, deism had been around for a long time, even if you want to look back through sort of Epicurean philosophical traditions and things like that. The ideas that Paine was advocating for rationalism and nature and those sorts of things have been around for a long time. But what he did is he made it accessible to the common people. And so the format and style of Paine's argument is what makes it notable, because he's disseminating these ideas in a format that is highly accessible to the common person. And so he's really important for sort of taking deism out of the realm of aristocratic philosophy and disseminating it more into the public. And people were quite worried about this. If you look at political and religious responses to Paine's Age of Reason, they're not so much worried about what he says. I mean, there's some hand-wringing over that for sure, but more about how he's saying it. That what if the common people lose religion, you know, it will turn into sort of a barbaric civilization or something like that. So Paine's important for his for the style and the content. So we start there with, you know, that's revolutionary and just post-revolutionary American period, and that gives way to a period we call, I guess sort of ironically, evangelical free thought, which are these people who are going around the country giving, say, talks or writing pamphlets or disseminating newsletters where they are trying to organize Americans who think of themselves as free thinkers, which is kind of the broad umbrella term that was used at the time for what's essentially secular thought. And so we have different interesting characters we try to profile. Abner Kneeland, who was the last person convicted of blasphemy in the U.S., who started a commune with free thought ideas in Iowa, which failed miserably. And Elihu Palmer, who was used to be an ex-Presbyterian minister who toured the country giving these eloquent speeches about science and reason and sort of the coming dominance of science. And my favorite one that we profile, the older ones, Frances Wright, who was the first woman in the United States to speak to in public what were called promiscuous audiences. I love this term, which is men and women gathered in the same room together. So she broke this promiscuous audiences barrier, and essentially what she was doing was going around and talking about philosophy, but what she was doing is she would take proceeds from her public talks and try to found organized secular groups and say things like, start a hall of science here, and it looks like a church, but really they're disseminating free thought. And so this period of just prior to the Second Great Awakening is really interesting in the sense that people are going out and kind of competing with religious evangelists to try to win people over to the side of free thought and to organize free thought in some kind of coherent way. Now, for the most part, this fails, and these groups lose out to organized religions, Methodists and Baptists and others in the Second Great Awakening. And so these organizations, for the most part, fail to stick around for a long time. But they do give us some clue into how these ideas were constructed and what people were trying to do with secularism, either as an identity or as an organizational idea during this period.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So that's right before the Second Great Awakening. So that's the early 1800s, the first two decades or so?
Yeah, Nealon, Abner Nealon, and Elihu Palmer are really active in those first couple of decades of the 1800s. Francis Wright, he is mainly active in the late 1820s and early 1830s. And so that's kind of the last gasp of this. Really, most of these organizations have died out by the 1850s to 1860s. And so there's kind of this flourish of the sort of effort to spread free thought ideas. And on some level, there's success in that. There's a lot of newsletters, and some of the ideas get further into the public. But the organizations, that is, organized secularism, fails to thrive. Well, we give, you know, we kind of break these up into these different historical periods. In the post-Civil War era, this is the first time we really see a widespread effort at non-theism. We call this evolutionary agnosticism. So you have lots of people who are using the ideas of Darwin, and a lot of this is coming from the academy. People who are using the ideas of Darwin to say that evolutionary ideas essentially mean that there's no creator or clockmaker necessary, and so we can have sort of perpetual doubt about theism now. There's reason to have perpetual doubt. And interestingly and kind of ironically, what happens is this is merged with a lot of progressivism and social gospel, sort of humanist ethics, to say that this allows a way for people to claim to be morally righteous, so that they'll claim humanist ethics without theism. It sort of allows a bridge to a way to say that you can be good without God. And so you have this kind of combination of evolutionary ideas with what are essentially liberal Protestant humanist sort of social gospel ideas. And we use Lester Ward as an example of this, who was the first president of the American Sociological Society, a terrible acronym, right? But it took a while for us to get rid of that one. But he's a very influential early sociologist who, in addition to writing sociology, edits a free thought newsletter and advocates for what is essentially a form of evolutionary agnosticism. And so here you kind of have this first larger movement into an effort and rhetoric that says a secularism that's explicitly non-theist in orientation. That's not to say there weren't non-theists before that, but it wasn't really much of a widespread idea until this late 1800s period, where you kind of have this combination of ideas from cutting-edge science with ethics from liberal Protestantism. Mm-hmm.
And then what happens?
Well, yeah, this transitions into, you mentioned, you know, the progressive era and some social policy. And so in some cases you have liberal Protestants and largely secular groups cooperating to achieve certain types of social gospel, social policies, and things like that. But really the most important things that are sort of the next really important eras are World War One and the first Red Scare. And this kind of transitions into a period we talk about the idea of othering, where atheism really is something that becomes othered against American identity and American culture. And this idea that atheism is linked to communism becomes something that persists really from World War One and especially through World War Two and up through the infamous sort of McCarthy hearings and things like that. And that also coincides, the high watermark of religious affiliation, as best we can tell, is in the 1950s. We note that in 1957, there's a large-scale poll run by Gallup that found that only 3% of Americans said they had no religion. And so, as far as we can tell, it seems to be the high watermark of affiliation, which also coincides with this sort of the fervor of demonizing atheism as being linked to communism. Mm-hmm. So historically, if we're trying to study secularism, that's probably the most important sort of next phase.
And then that leads us into this last phase, which is the contemporary era that you talk about. And you call this the Great Abdicating. Where'd that name come from, and what kind of era are we talking about here? Was this a gradual slide from the 1960s, or where?
That's an interesting question. It's more of, it's not so much a gradual slide, although there is a transition period. But there's more of like a lead up and then a rapid expansion. But it, so if we, first of all, we called it the Great Abdicating because I wanted something that was alliterative with the idea of like great awakenings. And so we have this idea of more people becoming religious, but we have more people dropping out of religion. So I thought, and as we try to note, that doesn't mean they're all becoming atheists, but what they are doing is abdicating their affiliation. So we try to come up with some sort of catchy title for this. We'll see if it sticks. But it kind of begins, sort of the beginnings of this sort of the sexual and gender revolution in terms of more women working and then particular loosening of attitudes about sexual mores, so things like premarital sex or birth control or homosexuality. And so you start to see some of the increasing liberalization of that in the 1960s and 70s. But that itself is not what leads to the Great Abdicating itself. What that does is that transitions into the reaction and the coalition of the religious right. So you're going to have this movement on the left for greater liberalization in the area of sexuality and gender, which is met on the right by the coalition of the religious right, which really gets going in the late 70s and early 80s. And it is the sort of coalition of the religious right and its effort to make lots of policy impact on issues of sexual politics that actually leads to then the abdicating section of it, which starts in the 1990s and really has continued through the present. And so it's really about gender and sexual politics, and this is what we mean by the changing of the political meanings of religion. Essentially what we mean by that is, in the 1950s or 60s, if I knew that a person was religious, it told me almost nothing about their vote choice. Whereas now, if you look at something like religious service attendance, it's a good predictor of vote choice, and especially if you look at forms of secularity, if I know you're an atheist or agnostic, I have a pretty good idea on your vote choice. And so we try to map this as being part of gender and sexual politics, and also as coinciding with increasing political polarization. And so we kind of, and again, this really starts in the 60s and 70s, and you can actually see it, you may have seen some of these studies in political science, where you can see it at the elite level, say, representatives to national party conventions, becoming, for the GOP, becoming more religious, and for the Democrats, becoming more secular, and that begins in the late 70s and early 80s, and then over time, it kind of filters to the public. So there's movement at the elite level before there's movement in the populace.
Yeah. What other things might be going on here? One of the things that I've been thinking about is the change in family structures. And this goes back to the generational issues that, back in the 1950s, everybody's getting married, I don't know, around 18, 19, 20 years old. And, you know, when you get married, you settle down, have kids. You want the kids to go to Bible school to have a good moral imprint. Nowadays, we're looking, especially throughout the 1990s and to the early part of the century, was you see people getting married in their 30s, mid-30s even.
Yeah, absolutely. And family structure is a big part of this. So there's a couple of things you mentioned there. The fewer people are getting married ever. So that is certainly feeding into this, because people who are not married are more likely to be secular. There's more cohabitation, which is in some ways clearly conflicts with what organized religions espouse. And so people who cohabitate are more likely to be secular as well. But even in beyond that, you have other things like higher divorce rates or higher rates of women working. And in a lot of ways, organized religions in the U.S. are still primarily focused on nuclear family structure and kind of traditional sexuality and gender roles. And in some ways, there's been a lot of push back against that. That is, family structure has changed and families are more dynamic and sexual habits are different and things like that. And so I think in some ways that cultural change has pushed against sort of organized religion. And again, you can see this expression and sort of the political expression of this in the religious right kind of versus the secular left. But I think family structure has a lot to do with it, and the fact that a lot of traditional organized religions still hew pretty close to the idea of kind of two parents, early marriage, three children with a stay-at-home mom. And so family structure is much more diverse than that, and so in some sense that is feeding this trend as well.
Is there any change in the meaning of religion? You talked about political polarization, changes in family structure, but the meaning of religion as well. I mean, that's deeply embedded in your book and what you're trying to flesh out. Have we seen people rethink the concept of what religion is in the past, 25, 30 years?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's two parts to that that are really important. One is the increasing sense of the politicization of religion. That is, people who now say no religion, if it had been 30 years ago, we say, what's your religion? They might have just thought, well, I was raised Catholic, so I'm a Catholic. But now, in some sense, there's so much political use of religion that people might think, well, if that's what it means to be religious, then I'm not religious. There's a little bit more of a pushback against the politicization of it. So that's an important change. And the other important change is the increasing privatization of religion in some ways, where people are wanting to mix and match different views. Maybe I want to explore Buddhism, or if you look at our other research, maybe I want to go on ghost hunts or go to a psychic or check my astrologer. And so people are doing more of this kind of a la carte mixing and matching of different things and privatization. And that's really what we find in this non-affiliated believer group. They have people in that category have higher levels of paranormalism. They're sort of religious dabblers. They're kind of trying on these different things. So you have two parts. You have the politicization, which is turning off some people who don't agree with kind of religious right politics, and then you have the privatization version of it, where people are going and kind of mixing and matching different ideas from different religions into some sort of privatized version, privatized amalgam of supernatural beliefs.
I want to finish off by talking about some of the implications of the changes that are occurring in the great abdicating, and I will help evangelize that term and make sure that it's connected with Joseph Baker and Buster Smith. The great abdicating. I actually like that term, by the way. What are some of the implications of the great abdicating? Where do you see, what have you been seeing in terms of changes within society, within politics, maybe race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, and where do you think this might be headed, in, say, the next decade or two?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, some of this you can see, and again, it's hard to pinpoint whether changing sexual mores are feeding into increased secularity or vice versa. In some ways, they're feeding each other, so some of these disputes over gender and sexuality you'll continue to see, but the American public as a whole has become much more liberal on a lot of these things. So I think that's one change to see. The other is more, at least in the last three or four major elections, there have been a pretty strong consolidation of seculars as a liberal voting bloc. Now, on the whole, aside from agnostics who vote at about the same rate as actively religious Americans, there's lower levels of political participation among this group. So, but when they do go and are politically active, it tends to be on the left. So I think this sort of consolidation on the left of the sort of the secular political movement, and then contrasted with the religious right, we'll probably see some more conflicts on this in the near future. Now, we're very careful to say that this doesn't necessarily mean that Americans will become much less religious, or that people will stop believing in the supernatural or things like that, in particular because demographically, religious people hold a considerable fertility advantage over secular people. Secular people tend to get married less, they tend to have fewer children, and so it would take an continuing increase in the apostasy rate for secularism to continue to grow. So it basically faces a long-run demographic disadvantage unless the apostasy rate continues to increase. So I would assume that there will be some plateauing at some point of the number of people who are secular. Now, we could be wrong about that. I mean, if you had asked us to predict in, 1986 what was going to happen in the next 20 years, I doubt we would have predicted the strong increase in the apostasy rate that we saw. So we could be wrong about that. But I think politics and, again, family structure is the place to watch this. And I think that's really where, really what it comes down to. That's the main sort of point of impact. Not that things like education or other issues like that don't matter, but it seems that gender and sexuality is really where a lot of the conflict and activity is.
We're seeing a lot of that in the United States today, and we've had a few podcasts on that as well in recent times. We'll point people back to that. My last question for you, one that is pretty common here on the podcast, is a chance for a little bit of self-reflection. Research is an ongoing process where you're asking questions, digging in data, looking at the data, see if it matches with your preconceived hypotheses or notions about how life is. Is there anything along the way in doing this book and in working with Buster Smith that really surprised you or that changed your mind and gave you a eureka moment?
Well, for the study of secularism in general, we knew that it was relatively diverse. But, I mean, the more we kind of dug into this, the more sense you get of how diverse this general category is and the need to really get in there and pull some of these different threads apart. And again, every time we pulled a thread and found something interesting, we came up with four or five more questions. So in a lot of ways, the hardest thing about the book is we try to cover so much ground, but I mean, there's so much more that needs to be done on this. And it's frankly a kind of a new area of research. So I think there's the viability of all the different types of secularities and secularisms, and to study them, I think, is really important. In terms of surprise, like our field in general, I remain a little, I guess I got into it thinking that what it would be is, the quote-unquote objective study of religion. I'd read all my Weber and my Durkheim and all these things and, thought that's kind of what we were doing. And I'm sometimes a little dismayed at how much people in our field tend to stick to either they're, like, committed to a particular paradigm or they're committed to religion is really good for you or religion is really bad for you. And so I think the sort of the challenge for the next generation of scholars is to drop the activism on some of that and to try to pull it apart, some of the nuance of this, and see how the empirical world is really operating, to make it less about sticking to preconceived ideas and more about what do the data say.
Well, that is a good lesson to have, and it's neat to see that for every question you answer and for every thread that you pull, you find a lot more questions to be asking, because that is the sign of a very healthy research agenda. And I'm sure we'll be checking in with you in the coming months and years to see where you're progressing with that. Your most recent book, American Secularism, Cultural Contours of Non-Religious Belief Systems, was just out last year with NYU. We'll point people back to that on our website. My guest today has been Joseph O. Baker. Joseph, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. Great to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.